And I mean, sometimes probably true for ultra running, you know, you might have a crew there and just run to the next aid station. And it's like, well, why don't you run to the next aid station, you idiot? You know? So I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, that it is easier to tell other people what to do than to do it yourself.
Hey, Andy, can you do me a favor? Can you just repeat this? Can you say, I'm Batman? Say it.
I'm Batman.
He could be Batman. He has the voice for it, doesn't he? I'm Batman.
Forget welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. Let's just go with I'm Batman.
Welcome to the Trailhead of Trail Runner Nation, where we go on virtual trail runs with interesting guests. And today's guest is a book. If it's your first time here, we welcome you. There's plenty of room on the trail, and we love to have you along with us.
We have gone on a rollicking, rolling trail run on this podcast. We've covered all kinds of ideas from the mundane to the profound, and I strongly suggest you give us a listen and get out and buy this book.
Whiskey Shots with Satan, Electric Dinotopia Carnival. What the heck, Freeman? Do you even know what those things have in common?
I have no idea, but I think it's a deep look inside of your head. What is this? Some kind of band from the 1970s? What is this?
Those are all names of Gooder sunglasses. Hmm. They have so many different styles, so many different frame colors.
And they match your personality, Scott. When we meet at the trailhead, I often look and see what Gooders you're wearing to see what kind of day I'm going to have.
They're no slip, no bounce. They're all polarized. They're just really good glasses. And here's the best thing. They have provided Trail Runner Nation members a discount, a 15% discount on their website at gooder.com. But this is the trick. You need to go to our webpage, trailrunnernation.com, click the deals tab at the top, scroll down and use the link there, and then use the code TRN15 to get that 15% off. Recently here in Northern California, we got some unseasonable rainstorms, which we desperately needed. But what that really did was it allowed me to unpack my Rain Runner pack jacket from John G. Oh, I love that jacket.
Well, the reason you love it so much, Scott, is because it's focused on breathability, water protection, which is perfect for our new climate. As fall begins, get prepared with new layers out now. In addition to the Rain Runner, John G has fast-drying Helotech long sleeves, weather-resistant transit tech pants, and ultra-light AFO middle shorts.
And one of the cool things that I think is kind of fun about John G is they have their collection series. The Fall-Winter 2022 collection is inspired by Chile and its extreme geography, the rainforest in the south, the deserts in the north, which push us to focus on layering.
John G covers the globe, and they cover you with the right gear.
And they can cover you for 15% off as a Trail Runner Nation listener. Go to johng.com and use the code TRN15, and you can get 15% off your order.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Andy Jones Wilkins.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War, and this is part two of our chapter-by-chapter book review of Do Hard Things, Why We Get Resilience Wrong, and the Surprising Science of Real Toughness. And to start this out, Don and I were on a run this morning. Well, let me back up a little bit. Don and I were planning to go on a run this morning, and it was a 7 o'clock start time, which isn't really that early, but boy, for some reason, I did not want to get out of bed. And so I was a little late. I texted Don and I said, I'm going to be a little late. I'm going to be about 15 minutes late. And I finally pulled myself out and I go, he's waiting for me. I got to go. And then I show up and Don's sitting there and we ensued on a conversation about how neither of us wanted to be there. That I asked Don, I said, so if I would have bailed, would you have continued? Would you have done the run without me? And what did you say, Don?
Well, Scott, I'll tell you, I was about 10 minutes into my drive when I received the text and I said, oh, he's texting. I wonder if this is a no-show. I wonder if he's trying to bail. I will turn around and I'll go home. Yeah, I was hoping for that, but it didn't happen. I'll tell you what I did with the time. So I got there a bit early. You're 15 minutes early. And you know what I did, Scott? Huh. I stretched. I stretched. I used that time to do some dynamic moving and stretching because I too didn't feel like running. A little bit stiff here, a little bit achy there. Like I had every excuse in the book I could conjure up that this is not a good run day. And I got there, and since I had free time, I just started swinging the leg, some Ian Sharman stuff. And nobody really thought I looked like Ian Sharman, but in my mind I did. And I'm swinging back and forth, and you know what? It limbered me up, and it got me started. I saw the value in that stretch.
So the reason we're telling this story is we're talking about the book, Do Hard Things. The easy thing to do this morning was to hit the snooze button and get maybe 30 minutes more rest, right? That's the easy thing to do. But for some reason or other, and accountability was one of those reasons, we both powered through. And as we were finishing our run, I made a comment. I said, you know, Don, I am so glad I came out today. I said, you know, those days that you really don't want to run, 95% of those times you finish and you just go, dang, I am so glad I did that run. And what did you say, Don?
Well, I said 95%. That means, no, Scott, I think it's not 5% that we don't have a good time. I think it's less than that. Because if it was 5%, we would hold on to that and we would hit the snooze alarm. I think it's very, very rare that we're not happy about going out of the run. AGW?
This story is great, guys, and a great way to kick off this episode and transition from the first episode. You might remember we talked about the importance of choice and control in building toughness, right? And debunking the notion of like drill sergeants or old school football coaches. In this scenario, you guys both had choice and control. And you were both teetering towards making the choice to go back to bed. But instead, you made the choice and took control of Don not saying, I'll turn around, using the 15 minutes to limber up and get ready for the run, and Scott saying, darn, we're going to have to do this. And an hour plus later, by exercising your choice and control, you got the run in and you were like, I'm so glad we got that done. I mean, that's the essence of toughness in a way. I'm sure you weren't thinking of it at the time, but it's the essence of toughness in the way Magnus discusses it in this book. So just a wonderful experience just right out of today that I think is important for us to realize. It comes up in our day-to-day life all the time.
And I think it builds for the fitness. I mean, consistency is so important. We talk about it, of getting out there and doing it. Scott's famous saying, you know, one is greater than none. And just getting out there. And we learned from someplace, somebody, somewhere, that the first 10 minutes are the most valuable of starting up your motor, starting up the engine of your body, and getting out there and using it. Those are the most beneficial 10 minutes of the entire exercise routine. So go get your 10. We all have time for 10.
I will give credit. That was David Roche. He said that the physical adaptations in the first 10 minutes is the most important. And so if all you can do is 10, do 10.
Well, and I would say, I mean, I know as I'm continuing my long recovery from my hip surgeries, that the 10 minute, though, it's really true. The first 10 minutes, it's really achy and creaky. I'm a morning runner, so everything is achy and creaky. And just the experience of knowing that the achy and creakiness is going to go away. And typically it goes away right around 10 minutes. In my little neighborhood loop I'm doing right now, it's right when I go by this elementary school and all the kids are being dropped off and I have to boost myself up and not hunch over, make myself look like a real runner as I'm going by all these elementary school kids getting dropped. But by that 10-minute mark, I'm ready to go and finish the hour and everything's good.
Isn't that crazy that we do that when we go by the elementary school kids that aren't paying attention? By the way, AJW, they don't care. They're not looking. but we do that when we're on the trail. If somebody is coming up, you don't want to get caught walking or hiking, right? Or even if they're non-runners, you don't want to have somebody on a horse or a bike see that you're walking along. Why do we do that? I have no idea.
No, I bust into a brisk 14 per minute mile jog and puff my chest out and shuffle along. And then as soon as I go by, I quick glance back and go right back into my hiking jog.
14 minutes. They're going to have some dust control rules around you, AJW. you can't run that fast on dirt trails.
Hey, we hope that after part one that we released a couple weeks ago, that you've purchased the book and you're reading it just like Oprah's book club. We hope that you're following along and getting your own ideas and maybe screaming at us saying, hey, you got that all wrong. Last part one, we did chapters 2, 5, and 6. So if you have your bingo card out, you can mark those three chapters. In this week's, we're going to go chapter 3, 7, and 11. It would be so easy for us to go 1, 2, 3, 4 in chronological order, but we are doing the tough thing. We're randomly selecting chapters. And I think, Don, you have chapter 3. What is chapter 3's title and what are we talking about?
Chapter 3, you know, it's a hidden gem in this book. I mean, it's so important. You know, I talked last week about chapter 6 being hidden in the middle. In case the book came across any elements, it would be protected, right? Well, now that I'm looking at chapter 3, I'm thinking, you know, chapter 3 is a wise chapter as well, and it has chapters 2 and 1 in front of it. I think it's protected, but it's really needed for the rest of the book. And it talks about ultra running, trail running, about doing hard things. It's perfect. As I read it, I'm thinking, you know, this was written for ultra runners. This is the Bible of ultra running. And here's the chapter: accept what you are capable of. And I've talked about that a lot. Accept what you're capable of. And here's how, at least I've talked about it, is know the vehicle that you're in. You know, you're signing up for a race. Your fitness may not be there. You may be 10 pounds overweight. Know the vehicle that you're traveling in so that you can monitor it, manage it properly. Know your course. Know the distance you're going in. Know where you expect to need to make some adjustments. And if they hit you all of a sudden, you expected it. Knowing your vehicle and accept what you're capable of. You guys have any thoughts on that? I've got more facts, but I just want to do a dissertation.
I have to jump right in here and say, I mean, I'll probably date myself, but he opens this chapter with a description of the presidential physical fitness test. And if you're our age, you remember being in elementary school and doing the presidential physical fitness test. And he has a reason for it, but he describes the 400 meter dash part of the presidential.
No, it's the 1 mile. Test. The 1 mile.
The one mile run where you've got a bunch of third graders on a track and they start out at a full blown sprint and they're going around. They get to like the second turn and the first one starts walking and the second one starts walking. And by the time they get one lap in, they're all pretty much walking and they sort of walk jog until the last 100 yards when they sprint. And it's just so great because it kicks off the chapter in talking about pacing and the importance of knowing your limits and how making yourself vulnerable and knowing your limits is a key part of the recipe for toughness. So I just loved how he introduced it with the good old presidential physical fitness test.
And I'll jump in also. It's the ability for us to embrace, to understand the reality of what we're getting ourselves into. And once we embrace that reality, we're able to be engaged and problem solve that issue that we're in. I think that's cool. If we have these crazy expectations that are outside of our ability, like let's say for crazy thought pattern that I get back into Western States and I go into Western States thinking that I'm going to podium. There's no reality there. That expectation is so far out of reality that there's no way that I can even start to comprehend. So when it comes time when there's tough things, it's very hard for me to problem solve because all of a sudden I'm my expectations are unreal.
I think that's why I probably started talking about know the vehicle you're in. I ran 2005 Western States. I think that's the one you got second place in, AJW. and I did well for myself. And I ran it again in 2013. I was in a different vehicle, but I was running my 2005 vehicle. There was no way that I had those mental marks in my head. I should be running this fast. I should be doing this. But looking in the mirror at my training and looking at my fitness level and maybe the weight, who knows, just a myriad of things. I wasn't in the same vehicle. I should have adjusted my effort. I should have reduced my expectations and been content with managing what I had successfully. And had I done that, I would have had a better finish time if I would have managed expectations. Heck, I ran through my body by mile, 30. And that was just ridiculous. I finished, but it was a death march for 70 miles. And that's not good. Here's a quote that he gave that I thought, oh, I should say this. And I thought, how could you say it better than this? So here it is, a quote. A tougher runner isn't one who is blind with ambition, but one that accurately assesses the demands of the situation. And toughness doesn't mean, covering your eyes up to all that's happening around you, ignoring any pain, not making decisions, just saying, I can tough this out. I'm bigger than this problem. That's not a recipe for success. That good decision-making comes with taking in information around you, knowing your course, having experience, accurately watching some of these biometrics comes in, your heart, your respiration, and then you can project a good outcome. Making good decisions come from being aware and in present time, running in real time, not just being, quote unquote, the old adage, tough and bury yourself into it. Scott?
I think the quote, it may be a quote, I can't remember, but he says the formula for being tough is accurately assessing the situation that you're in and accurately assessing your abilities, appraising your own abilities, and then appraising the situation, using both of those as variables to problem solve through the situation.
Right. You gave one of those toughness maxims he talks about, embrace reality, appraise the demands in front of you, and then really think about, what am I capable of if I take all this information in and apply it appropriately? And just don't let it happen to you. Be the captain of your ship.
The line that really resonated with me, Don, in that same section is, a key component of real toughness is acknowledging when something is hard, not pretending it isn't. I thought so much about long, hard ultramarathons in that context. Take Western States. Let's just acknowledge that it's going to be hot. Accept that it's going to be hot. Don't ignore that it's going to be hot. Or a high altitude 100 like Hard Rock. Acknowledge that you're going to go slower. Your breath, you're going to be short of breath and so forth. It's going to be hard if it starts raining, if it gets cold, if there's a longer place between aid stations. So I love that he's, so much of, block out the pain or ignore the pain or don't worry, it's not going to be so fat or, bad or to toughen up. He's saying, he's flipping that on its head. Accept it. Dude, it's going to be hard. Don't pretend it's not. If running 100 miles is hard. And I love that. And not only as a metaphor for running, but a metaphor for life.
And I think you touched on something that's really super important there, AJW, that you can't BS your way through a tough situation. If it's hard and you keep on telling yourself, oh, this is a piece of cake, that climb up to Devil's Thumb, that's a cakewalk. That's easy. You can't BS your brain. You need to acknowledge the reality of the situation. And once you do that, then it opens up this door of choice and of solutions to the problem. Going from here up to Devil's Thumb is a hard, hard climb. That Devil's Thumb could be whatever metaphor in life, whatever metaphor in racing or training, that hill that is just so hard. Acknowledge that it's hard, and that it almost opens up the freedom to choose, the freedom to problem solve the situation.
You guys have set me up for the next piece that he talks about. And believe me, there's so much to choose from. This even just chapter 3 in this book is stuffed full of just knowledge and golden nuggets, as Scott likes to call them. And he takes, when we're in a situation, we need to perceive that situation as either a threat or it's a challenge. When we acknowledge that it's a threat, then that's life-threatening, and there's chaos and catastrophe that goes on. There's a host of self-talk that happens, negative talk, and a cascade of chemicals, cortisol that's a stress chemical and different hormones. So when we're in a stressful environment, our body is saying, there's danger, we could die from this, but that's one way to look at it. The other, the successful way that people look at it, is they frame it as a challenge. And when you have challenge, then you've been through it, done it before, you have experience at it, you can anticipate the outcome because you have that veteran experience. And then you end up with chemicals like adrenaline and testosterone that are released. And those can be useful. How you get through either threat or challenge, you need to be clear-eyed. You need to be able to take in information and process it, and then make your next course correction. And people that see things as a challenge can make a sound course correction. The people that see a threat are very protective. They pull in, and they can't execute. And so you're at a big risk during the threat, and you're just trying to survive. But challenges that people do, they're successful with their outcome, and they're predictable.
So Don, you mentioned that experience allows you to look at something as a challenge. What if you're not experienced? What if you're a first-time half marathoner? You don't know what to expect. Is everything that comes at you a threat, or can you frame that as a challenge even though you don't have the experience?
Well, I think new challenges, until you can understand them and process them, they probably all come at you as a threat. Then you can identify, oh, this is something in training that I've experienced. I've read about this. I've heard my friends talk about it. I should do this. So then you can change that initial threat when the bell rings, threat, and then process it and place it into the challenge category. But you need some experience, either from a friend, from reading, from a podcast, something to say, this has happened to others before. They survived. I'm gonna handle this as a challenge now. But you can easily get yourself and keep yourself in a threat situation. They put on he gave a nice example of a rookie jumping from a plane, so a parachute person jumping from a plane. There's a lot of threat there.
A parachute person?
Yeah. What are those called? Parachutists? Plane jumpers? I don't know. So you've got this rookie, and he's got a threat. Is he standing there getting ready to jump out of this plane? But then you have your veteran jumper, and he has a lot of excitement. He has adrenaline and all the good feelings coming around because he knows the outcome. He's not worried. He knows where the ripcord is placed. So, and I think that happens to us on the trail. First time we have a bonk in some type of situation, or we've been in that bonk before. We pull from past experience. And so there's a lot of value in being a veteran or connecting with a veteran or asking veterans about what do I do when? How many times did you ask that, AJW, to your mentors? And Scott, same to you. How many times did you ask, hey, do we run this hill? Hey, what happens when we puke? Hey, how do you, there's so much just basic info that you just drill and ask, your mentors.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the great things about our sport is there's those people out there. There's always someone out there with more experience than you. I wanted to mention very early in the book, Magnus makes a quick reference to one of my all-time favorite sports movies, A League of Their Own, which was from the 90s. It was starred Tom Hanks as a kind of gritty, grizzled old baseball coach, coaching an all-women's baseball team during World War II. There was an all-women's baseball league that was created during World War II because there was no men's baseball. Anyway, Tom Hanks plays this character, and the line that Magnus refers to just in chapter one is his famous line of "There is no crying in baseball," which is just sort of saying to his team, "Tough it up, don't cry." But the flip side of it is one of the most poignant moments in the film, and it's related to this true toughness and acknowledging when something is difficult and accepting that it's difficult. Gina Davis, the character, she's kind of the pitcher on the team. She was about to quit. She was ready to give up, and she's folding her head in her hands and says, but it's just so hard. And Hanks looks her in the eye and says, "Of course it's hard, but it's the hard that makes it great."
Mm-hmm.
And that his he was giving her permission to accept that it's hard, but the hard makes it great. Giving up and quitting and going back to whatever she was doing, she could do that. And there was some greatness in it being difficult and hard. I'll never forget that line from that movie. And it's one I've used with my kids before when they've said, "Oh, but it's so hard." Or I've even used it, tried to pull it out at aid stations sometimes when someone is ready to drop out because it's so hard. So it is the hard that makes it great. And I like how Magnus, you know, says, you know, it's going to be difficult, except that it's going to be difficult. And maybe it's even going to be great.
Before we move on to Scott's chapter 7 and AJW's chapter 11, I'm going to end with the title that we started with for chapter 3 and how profound I think the use of this word accept what you are capable of. And I don't take that as a negative thing at all. I take it as I know my body and I understand the situation I'm in. And if I navigate and negotiate and strategize a way, I can make it through this. And accept that you are capable. And I think it's very empowering. I think this is just a wonderful chapter. And if you have this book and you only had time to read two chapters, I would recommend chapter 3 and chapter 6. Those are the two chapters that I worked on.
Hey, I have a question about that. So it kind of is a contradiction. In many cases, we're doing things that we've never done before. So can you accept where you are and still push yourself beyond your capabilities?
I think you have to have internal confidence that anything that comes at you, you're going to be able to negotiate a way around it, and that you're going to be resourceful, MacGyver your way through the situation. And whatever comes at me, I'm ready for, and I'm going to figure it out. And I think that's what's so beautiful about our sport. It's so complex. It's so sophisticated. There's so many things going on that there is, you don't have time to listen to music and bebop down the trail because you are busy navigating these catastrophes that are all waiting for you. So I think you can, to answer that question, Scott, I think you can absolutely make your way through if you have internal confidence and apply your tools and your instinct.
So, Andy, as a coach, you're dealing with this on a regular basis, where you're helping someone get to a new level of performance. I guess that the accept your ability doesn't necessarily mean the current ability of the furthest training run you've done, because a lot of people, before they run their first 100-mile race, they've never run 100 miles. I think there's a balance there where you need to accept your abilities. And I think you were alluding to this, Don, accepting not the mile or the distance limit. You're accepting your ability to persevere, your ability to problem solve, your ability to think through and think of something as a challenge. It's not necessarily the hour mark or the mile mark.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I actually have a up to the minute kind of anecdote on that. An athlete that I've been working with for about 8 months just finished the Arkansas Traveler 100 miler. A year ago, dropped out of the Arkansas Traveler 100 miler, maybe around mile 60, and set about from that moment on to sort of right the ship and come back a year later and get the finish. He was kind of at rock bottom when he had that. He didn't have a coach at the time. He runs a lot of ultras, you know, does pretty, you know, finishes 50 milers and 100Ks, but hadn't kind of gotten that Arkansas Traveler finish that he really wanted. He's got, you know, he has a dream of running Western States. He gets qualifiers and so forth. Well, he set about to this year when he signed up for coaching all through the summer and the hot months of the summer, doing the training, he lives in a place that's pretty flat. He got on an incline treadmill. He just put in the work. There was no subs. He knew what he was in for because he had dropped out the year before. He knew he had to do better. He had to accept his limits. He wasn't going to win. He probably wasn't going to break 24, But he also had to know and had to convince himself that he was going to do better than the previous year when he dropped out. And it made my day. On Sunday morning, I woke up, and on my text, there was one text. It says, I'm at mile 86. I'm going to finish.
Nice.
I mean, it was, he had plenty of time on the clock at that point. And I mean, it was the euphoria that he felt and that I felt a little bit on his behalf, or a lot of it on his behalf, is kind of what you're talking about, Scott. You've got to know your limits, but then you've also got to push, you know, kind of right up to the edge of those sometimes if you want to achieve something that, you know, is really, really hard.
I think one thing I was trying to convey, and I think that we use a negative connotation of the word accept. So I looked it up as AJW was telling his story, and part of the definition is to believe or come to recognize. So believe or come to recognize. Recognize your potential. Recognize you're bigger than your problem. Accept who you are as an amazing, capable machine that's going to get it done. That's accepting what you are capable of. Accept the fact that you are amazing. And so I think it's a great title, because accept can be used two different ways and make two different definitions of the sentence.
Mm-hmm. Good point. I think that idea of acceptance, you're right. It's similar to vulnerability. It has a negative connotation, but I think you know, when you flip it like you just did, Don, you really are. You're opening yourself up to become something more, something bigger, something stronger. Indeed, something tougher.
And if you're running down the trail and your negative self-talk and you're accepting what you're capable of in a negative way, you're not going to have a very good outcome or a good experience. You need to spin it some way and start, you know, being your greatest cheerleader. Chapter 3 deserves the whole podcast, Scott, but let's move on.
When we're out on the trails, there are mountains, there are valleys going up and down. And that's one of the things that we love to do. What we don't love to do is have those ups and downs in our energy and in our gut.
And UCAN is a solution. It's what Scott and I drink out on the trail. It's a long-lasting energy source, not a sugar that dumps a lot of sugar into you, spikes your blood glucose, and drops you off the other end. And that is the definition of a bunk. You don't want that.
With UCAN, it's a slow-burning superstarch that keeps you out there and keeps you steady, whether you're going up the hill or down the hill.
Trail Runner Nation has a starter pack, a box of bars, a box of gel energy for those who really want to put UCAN to the test.
And you can get that for a reduced rate. You want to go to trailrunnernation.com, click on that deals tab, scroll down, and you will see that you can get 20% off. With that link, you'll click on that link and use the code TRNSTARTER to get 20% off. I was going to say, let's talk about that self-talk. And that's what chapter 7 is all about. The title is Own the Voice in Your Head. And I'm going to be an editor for Steve Magnus on this. I think that it should have read, Own the Voices in Your Head, as the chapter heading, because he goes through the chapter and talks about the different voices in your head. The old maybe interpretation or belief of what toughness is said that anytime you had any kind of negative voice or negative chatter or negative thoughts, that you needed to get rid of those voices, that you needed to ignore them, that those will make you weak. And that tough people don't let negative enter their mind. And Steve gets into this and says, you know what, that's probably not a good thing. And he starts the book with a really good analogy of a real story of someone that was crossing the Atlantic in a boat. I'm going to let you read that on your own. But then he goes into and makes an analogy of the widely popular movie by Disney called Inside Out. And after reading chapter 7, I haven't done it yet, but I need to go back and watch that movie, because if you're not aware of the movie, there are four characters in that movie. And one is joy, sadness, disgust, and anger. And there are these four animated things in this boy's head. Riley is his name. And the whole the whole thing talks about these situations that Riley gets into in his life and have these four voices in his head that are arguing with one another. And I think the important thing that Steve brings out in this book is it's okay to listen to those voices. You know, we all remember back on the Roadrunner, Bugs Bunny Hour, if you're old enough, they had these cartoons where there was a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other shoulder, and they would argue with each other, similar to this morning where I had a devil on my shoulder saying, "Scott, go back to bed. You don't need to run this morning." And I needed to give that, well, I didn't need to give that voice time or a place to talk. But what I needed to do is now listen to the other side. The devil is saying, "Hey, you don't need to go run. You're tired. You were up late. You know, you have a big presentation tomorrow. You better get your sleep." That's the devil on the shoulder. The angel, on the other hand, give voice to that one too when they're saying, "You know what? If you get up and you run, you're going to perform better. Your mental acuity is going to be stronger, and you'll have more energy throughout the day if you do this." And allow those voices to talk to you and give them place, but then you decide which one is you're going to pay attention to so that you can attain the goal that you're trying to attain to.
Scott, have you seen somebody for this condition you have?
But I think that's an important thing. And something that I'm taking away from this book is a lot of times I will say, "You know what? I don't want to have those negative thoughts in my head." And it's okay to give those negative thoughts a space. And in fact, Steve makes a point that sometimes those negative thoughts are the ones that you need to listen to, because those are the ones that are going to help you perform at the strongest. Like, for example, in Inside Out, there's a point where disgust is the one that Riley's brain listens to, and it was the right time to listen to that voice.
Scott, I didn't mean to give you a bad time about your condition, but I think it's so important to learn how to control the dialogue that happens in our brain. We can let somebody take over. We can let negative talk or the wrong voice have the center stage when we need to, like you said, give it its time, let it say its piece, and then move it on. And then give a well-rounded discussion, not just one-sided. I think sometimes out in the deep, dark miles, I just listen to the negative talk and I'm trying to clear it out. So, you know, how do you do that, AJW? How do you get rid of the negative dialogue?
I had a great relationship with a legendary cross-country running coach back at my school in Philadelphia, high school cross-country running coach. And I think everybody listening to this podcast knows sort of the idea of the mantra of getting teaching yourself to have some set of words, a sentence, a phrase that you focus on. This coach Rentschler was his name. He's since retired, but cross-country coach at this school in Philadelphia that won state championship after state championship. And a lot of his preseason was helping the player, the runners, get the voices in their head right. He knew they were going to have voices in their head. He knew sometimes they were going to be negative. And some of the self-talk and the mantra is negative. I mean, there's no more famous version of this than the now retired German cyclist Jens Voigt. Listeners of this might know. Jens Voigt was famous for saying, "Shut up, legs. Shut up, legs." His legs would be screaming going up a climb. There were times he even said it loud. It became a marketing thing. You'll see cyclists with shirts that say, "Shut up, legs." Well, this was what Coach Rentschler did back at Penn Charter. And it invariably, and you know, halfway through the season, he would, you know, go through the various runners and say, "Okay, you got your, well, you know, what are you focusing on today?" And it would change what their mantra was or what their self-talk was. But what it allowed him to do is make that piece of self-talk the loudest one, so that if there was other talk of doubt in the athlete, it would drown that out. Not suppress it, because Magnus is very clear in saying we've got to accept the self-talk, we've got to accept the reality, but to somehow try to manipulate it was what Coach Rentschler did so well, and made a relatively mediocre group of runners into repeat league champions because they exceeded expectations when it was all on the line in the final meet. So it was a kind of cool thing, and I remember being a young teacher and watching him do this with his runners and thinking that's pretty cool.
I don't think that negative self-talk there is to try to purposely sabotage us. That's not the role. It's trying to get our attention that something needs to be handled. Something's going on. It's either low calories, low electrolytes, low fluid, too much effort. There's something, too much, altitude, whatever it might be, something's happening. So if you're not listening and you're stuffing stuff down and you're ignoring those voices, you haven't given its opportunity to be heard. And so you make a course correction and then you can ask it to be quiet. I think just being stubborn doesn't quiet a voice or solve a problem. You need to hear it. Ask yourself, why is this being vocal? What can I do to change it, to shut it up?
Or should I listen to it? I think that's the key, that sometimes that negative voice is the right voice to listen to. But let's move on a little bit. He talks about that inner debate with all those different voices, and he comes up with some three basic things. But here are the ones that I came up with. Is one, that positive inner voice may not be the best thing for you. University of Waterloo, and this is one of the things I love about Steve, and I think Andy brought this up in the last episode, the part one that we did. It's not just stories. Steve brings in the science and the research. And in these next two examples, Steve brings in some research that prove his theory here. University of Waterloo found that positive self-talk worked as long as the subject had high self-esteem. If they had low self-esteem, positive self-talk could actually be detrimental. In other words, your brain isn't going to be fooled by false bravado. So you can't lie to yourself. I think I said that earlier. I think that's something to take into account. The other one is fascinating, this research that they did with some six-year-olds. And they were supposed to, they were put into a room to accomplish a task. They were to look at a screen, and I can't remember the exact details, but if they saw a piece of cheese, they were supposed to hit the button. If they didn't see a piece of cheese, they were not to do anything. So it's a really boring task, but they were supposed to do it for like 10 or 15 minutes. And in competition was an iPad sitting on the table next to them that had a lot of fun games. And then they were given the task. You need to do this for 15 minutes and it's going to be hard, but here's what you need to do. And they split them up into three groups. And one was talk to yourself positively and say, I can do this. I'm going to be a big help on this task. I am going to do this. And think that way. The second group was to actually name themselves. So in this example, I'd say, Scott, you're doing a great job. Scott, you're going to complete this task. Scott, you're going to be successful in completing this task. And the third group was even further distanced. If you can see the transition here from self to actually naming yourself. And now the third group was to pick a character that they admired or a hero that they had, like Batman or Bob the Builder. These are six-year-olds. These aren't me. Although I would be Batman if I could. And they were going to say, hey, Batman is tough. Batman is going to finish this. Batman is not going to give in to the iPad. Batman. And they found that through the progression, as you distance yourself in your self-talk, you are more successful. So in the end, the people that were doing, the little kids that were doing self-talk and using Bob the Builder or Batman were actually 60% better at completing the task than those that were saying, I'm going to do this or Scott's going to do this. And I thought that was fascinating because a lot of times when I'm having a tough time, I'll either say, come on, Scott, you can do this. You can do this. Or come on, I'm better than this. I can make it to the top of the hill. I've never tried the this method of distancing myself even further. And he brings up the fact that, you know, if a friend came to you and asked you for advice, you would be more blunt in the decision. So if someone, was having a tough time getting out on the trail or getting out to run, and they came to you and say, you know, what do I need to do? It would be much easier for you to tell your friend, hey, this is what you need to do. You need to get up every morning. You need to be disciplined, la, 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 la. It's easier to do that than to give yourself a recommendation or yourself a prescription. So anyway, what did you think of that when you read that?
I love that part. It's applicable in my life a lot, this adage that it's easier to give advice to someone else than to yourself. I mean, I've had it in my professional life where I've had people tell me, oh, you need to fire that teacher, or, oh, you need to expel that kid. I mean, in the most extreme examples. And it's like, well, you're telling me, you think that's let's see you do it. You know what I mean? So this idea of externalizing, you know, the Batman thing is a good one. Like that that really resonated with me. And I mean, sometimes it's probably true for ultra running, you know, you might have a crew there and just run to the next aid station. And it's like, well, why don't you run to the next aid station, you idiot? You know? So I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, that it is easier to tell other people what to do than to do it yourself.
Hey, Andy, can you do me a favor? Can you just repeat this? Can you say, I'm Batman? Say it.
I'm Batman.
He could be Batman. He has the voice for it, doesn't he?
I'm Batman.
Hey, Ryan, can you take that out and edit that for us, please?
I think it's time for a new intro to the podcast anyway. I think that would be forget welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. Let's just go with I'm Batman and then start talking.
AJW, you've coached a lot of people to success from novices to veterans. Do you think that you're a better coach for them or a better coach for yourself? Are you able to coach yourself as well as you coach others?
Ooh, good question.
Probably not. I'm kind of where I learned the most about the sport and what I've done to be an athlete, what I've done to succeed in athletics is taken little bits and pieces of wisdom and advice and knowledge from a lot of different places. I am not as comfortable, you know, as many people are with having one voice of authority or one idea of authority guiding me along the way. I'm better off with a collective group. And so I think coaching other people makes me a better athlete myself, but I think they're really two separate things. And in fact, it's difficult for me it's gotten easier, but when I was closer to my competitive years as a runner, I would oftentimes tell my own anecdotal stories to my athletes and say, well, I did this to get over nausea, so if you do it, you'll get over nausea. And I don't do that anymore because no one's interested in hearing what I did. They want to know what helps. They want to know what helps them, you know, do it. So that's a learning process. But I think were I to, and I don't think I'm going to do this. I'm in a very different stage in my actual my competing career or being in races. If I was going to pursue something that I thought would be really, really challenging and difficult, like we've talked about on the podcast here for years, like a 200-mile race, which is still, you know, clanging around in the back of my head there, I would probably get a coach. I mean, I would say that. That's something that's so far out of my realm of understanding that I think I would need a coach to succeed in a 200-mile race.
All right. Well, we're to our final chapter of this part two episode, and Andy's going to ruin the book by giving us the last chapter, chapter 11. What's that chapter, Andy?
Chapter 11 is it's titled Find Meaning in Discomfort, talk about a golden nugget for ultra running, right? We often, a version of that we say is you need to get comfortable being uncomfortable. right? I think that's just something we know as you're in a long event, you're going to be out there for a long time, you're going to be uncomfortable. So the title right away just jumps off the page. It's the final chapter of the book. And in many ways, Magnus is tying up the previous 10 chapters in a nice bow and basically challenging society to have a different view of toughness. But he starts the chapter with a description of Viktor Frankl, a concentration camp survivor who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, an incredible book. And in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, Frankl spent a lot of time, touring around the world, giving lectures to, CEOs and athletes and educators and people who wanted to have a more fulfilling life. And in his sort of signature speech that he probably gave 100 times, but has its roots in A Man's Search for Meaning, he says there are three things that all people need for a fulfilling life. They need to create something. They need to experience life authentically. At this point, everybody in the room is they're at the edge of their seat. Yes, create, absolutely. Do something. Experience, yes, live their life. And then his third one, his punchline, and they need to experience suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like you could hear a pin drop in the room. And there's this wonder and joy in creating and this great feeling of euphoria and being connected with nature and experiencing authentic life. And then he said, and you've got to suffer. Now, of course, he's got tremendous credibility on suffering. He was 4 years in a concentration camp. As you talked about in last week's episode, Scott, he knew there were two things he could control every day. He could comb his hair and he could stand up straight, right? And you get the concentration camp, while it's so much more brutal and harsh than anything we would experience in ultra running or athletics. And the lesson of it, it's a simple three-part lesson where you get in there and you feel shock. It's like, what the heck are they doing in here? I'm just going to die here. To then, as we talked about in my chapter last week, you become apathetic. Oh, I mean, there's nothing I can do. I'm stuck here. I'm going to die here. To then, if you comb your hair and stand up straight, find some source of meaning. For Frankl, he thought about his family back in Germany. He thought about that. That kept him going. That gave him hope. They talked about prisoners of war. I remember hearing an interview with John McCain years ago about that kept him going, wanting to see his father again, wanting to be present in his home in Arizona and be among his beloved family in Arizona. That kept him with some sense of meaning while he was a prisoner of war. What Frankl says is that sense of purpose, that you've got to have purpose, will help defeat the suffering. But the suffering is eternal. And I'm reminded of the old, the Buddhist maxim, which is, suffering is universal. It's the one thing we all have in common as humans. We all suffer. And until you achieve a lack of, and even in Buddhism, right, you're reincarnated over and over and over again until you achieve nirvana. And when you achieve nirvana, you no longer suffer and you don't have to come back. I mean, it's beautiful, right? Until then, you have to keep coming back. But once you achieve nirvana, you don't have to come back. And of course, that's defeating of all suffering. And then Magnus tells this great story, and this gets at the point of like motivation and focus. He talks about his dog. He's got a wonderful dog that he runs with every day. He has a nice 4 mile loop, and this dog runs along, pretty speedy dog, runs along at like 7 minute miles right next to Steve, But he talks about how sometimes, the weather gets a little worse and it's more humid and hot, and the dog can make it really well, like the president's fitness test people, for like 2 miles, but then slows down. But he says there's one thing that no matter how tired and sluggish the dog is, there's one thing that's going to shake him out of that apathy. Squirrels. And he says when he's doing this 4 mile loop and he's getting down to a 10 minute mile, if he sees a squirrel, it's like a light switch goes off and he's chasing and going and pulling at the leash again. And his point, while it's a funny story, his point is that that drive, it's the same thing that, you know, you hear these superhuman stories of people lifting cars off of people when they see it, or, you know, jumping over walls that, you know, when they're filled with, as Don's chapter talked about, when they're filled with adrenaline. And I mean, this dog sees the squirrel and it's like, go. And if, and so for back to Frankl and that, and in the midst of that suffering, if you find that thing that keeps you going, you find that thing that keeps you driving forward, whether it's finishing a 100-mile race, getting to the next aid station, or maybe finally, after 1,000 tries, actually catching the squirrel, which, of course, you then realize if the dog catches the squirrel, what the heck's the dog going to do with the squirrel? But, of course, that's the beauty of squirrels. They never get caught by these dogs. but I think out of all of that, out of that notion of creating, experiencing, and suffering, and having that motivation and drive to push through, you know, Magnus ties a neat bow around the book and takes a lot of the strands that we've been talking about, whether it's about control, whether it's about autonomy, whether it's about, you know, working hard, whether it's about your inner voices in your head, how you can harness those in a way that allows you to have a fulfilling life. And his point is, we need to be tougher. Our society needs to be tougher, and we need a new way of looking at toughness. And he believes this is the way.
As we're talking about finding meaning in discomfort, the question I'm going to pose, and then I'm going to do a little anecdote. The question is how do we learn that? How do we learn to find meaning in discomfort? And then I'm going to refer back to Don's story that he's told many times on the podcast, where he was at an aid station before he had ever run an ultra. And he saw these people coming through that were absolutely suffering, and him saying, I need to get me some of that. I need to find there's some meaning in that discomfort. I need to find that meaning. And then I refer back to, and you can all go out and find this on YouTube, on the Trail Runner Nation YouTube channel, which we only have a few YouTube videos on there. But there's one of Don at the Moab 240. Where he is in discomfort, and he's talking his into a camera about all of the, he has some negative voices there, and he's in discomfort, obviously. And it's so motivating knowing that he worked through that and eventually finished the Moab 240, which that year was the Triple Crown of 200 finish. And there's a lot of meaning behind that for Don. There's a lot of meaning behind that for me, because he's a friend and I got to see him go through that. But my question to both of you is, how can we find meaning in discomfort? How can we embrace it? How can we find the good in discomfort? That's a universal issue. How do you, Don?
Well, first, Scott, I'd like to say that video I took of myself was for me, so that I could see the voice that was speaking, because I wanted to think, was I really that bad? I want to see me at my lowest when I was ready to cut the band and quit. So I'm going to know by looking at that, was I really that bad or just a wimp? And then I sent it to you and you shared it with everybody, and then went ahead and did it on the podcast too. Is there meaning behind suffering? How do we place meaning? Is that the question?
Yeah. How do you learn that?
I think that we need, I think we need to experience some of that suffering so we can see, feel, and experience the real joy. If we're walking around in nirvana based on AJW's story, if everything's always, you know, perfect and rainbows and lollipops, then we stop seeing the meaning and striving for things to get better. And so I think that we need to dip down and go low so we can then climb out and go high. And it's like the profiles on the trail. It's variable, and we need that. AJW?
I think this is a very good question, and this answer is going to sound kind of like a cop-out, but I really don't think there's one answer to how we find meaning in discomfort. I think discomfort or suffering or despair is so personal. Mm-hmm. We can say, you know, you can come across someone at an aid station and say, oh, I was once puking, you know, at an aid station, and I just took Tums and kept going. You know, there's always people there to tell you that. But really, it's such a those deep, I mean, like in the movie you described, those emotions that are really hard, like despair and suffering, are so personal. Of course, there's times that they're shared, right? If seven people are in a lifeboat and they're freezing cold, they're all suffering, and they're all kind of suffering in the same way, but they're also perhaps all suffering in their own individual pain cave, if you will. So I think that before we decide how to find meaning, we need to kind of parse out the experience and why it's discomforting for people. In some cases, it's obvious. In some cases, it's not so obvious. And then once we parse out why it's so discomforting, then we figure out how to find meaning in it.
I love that. And it comes to, I guess, maybe my interpretation is you cannot find meaning in the discomfort by reading a book. Or listening to a story, or listening to Viktor Frankl talk about his suffering. You're not going to find it by that. You have to find it through your own experiences, through your own discomfort. Now, here's the golden nugget, Don, is as you're going through that discomfort, just like we learn from Viktor Frankl and we learn from Steve in this book, as we're going through that discomfort, realize that we have choice. Frame it as a challenge rather than a threat. Realize that you have choice, and through that choice, you have hope. And that hope can be the driver that gets you through that challenge, and then you can find meaning as you're going through it or after you've gone through it.
Boy, well said, Scott. When you asked that question, I didn't have much time to prepare, but listening to you two inspired me to think that suffering really is the essence of the human experience. When you look at all of our ancestors, we all suffered to make it this far. We're designed to overcome obstacles. Our DNA really is inspired and dances and celebrates. When we get through a period of suffering and get out on the other end, we really are built to be survivors. And that's why I think that everybody in life shares suffering, because it is living and being human.
Well, and let's circle all the way back to the start of the podcast, because while what you guys experienced this morning was not necessarily suffering, it was nonetheless, when that alarm went off, Scott, you just wanted to roll over and go to bed and, you know, wake up an hour later and start your day. And Don secretly was hoping that you were not going to show up, because then he could just drive back home and do the same thing. But instead, you guys, you know, that small version of suffering, you looked that in the eye and you said, nope. Don's waiting for me at the trailhead. Don said, oh, Scott's coming. Better do some Ian Charman exercises. And you ended up doing the run, and an hour later felt so much better, and none of it was about suffering. So you found some hope in the midst of that little despair moment. It's a small example of, you know, from day-to-day life, but we have hundreds of those in our day-to-day life. And it's, as Magnus says, it's what we do in those moments that makes us tougher. And I think even that little example for you guys, it added a little extra layer of toughness for the next time the alarm goes off and you don't want to show up for a run with Don.
You know, and some of that same toughness shows up on race day, trail day, long training run day. All of those pile up, contribute, and build to becoming a tougher runner when you practice over and over, even in small bites. Practice toughness, whether it's getting up early in the morning and getting out to the trail, whether it's resisting that extra dessert at the end of the night. All these things are pieces of toughness. Toughness doesn't just drop on you all at once. You practice it along the way, and you have success along the way. And then when you need to ring the toughness bell, that you can call back to all those experiences, and you show up and accept who you are, which is an amazing, tough person.
And discipline. You know, if I was frankly being honest with everybody, my running has not been as disciplined and regular and consistent as I would hope it would be, or as I would like it to be. If you are disciplined and every morning the alarm goes off, sometimes you just don't even hear that devil on your shoulder, right? Mm. You don't realize that there's a choice that needs to be made because you've already made it. You made it yesterday and you felt good. You made it 2 days ago and you felt good. So if I do it today, I'm going to feel good. And I think that that's important too. We hope that this episode, part two, has inspired you to buy the book. You need to buy it. As I think I mentioned, Don and I both bought the audio version. And before we finished the audio version, we both went out. I bought a hardback copy and Don bought a Kindle version. I know Andy has gone through this book multiple times. This is a reference guide. This is not a storybook that you read one time and put it on the shelf. This is one like Endure, Alex Hutchinson's book, Endure. It's one that can be referenced over and over, and you can get something out of it every time. I'm going to give you an example. Last week, Don talked about chapter 6, and I went back, even though I had already read it, I went back and listened to chapter 6 again, and there was so much more that came out of it. I got a lot more meaning, a lot more understanding from that because of the conversation that we had on the podcast. So go out and get it. The book is called Do Hard Things: Why We Get Resilience Wrong and the Surprising Science of Real Toughness. It'll turn your definition of toughness on its head, like Andy has said. Steve Magnus does a great job.
Yeah, fantastic book. I will just echo everything you said, Scott. And this has just been great to really dive into it, to really dive into the themes, the ideas. And you're right. It's one you don't want to just tuck away on your bookshelf. You want it right next to your bed or right on your desk. It's a reference guide to how to be a better athlete, how to be a better person, how to be a better member of society. In fact, I think if more people read this book, probably be a better world.
Mm. Should we send one to Putin? Maybe.
So go grab a book and run.
Mas. Should we send one to Putin?
Should we send one to Putin?
And now we've reached the end of the podcast, really the finish line, Scott, where we give high fives as we're coming through the big arch. And we're going to thank our executive producer and editor, Ryan Warr.
And our social media guru, Yana Gibalova.
And our website graphic engineer, Katie Burke.
We also want to thank the Patreon supporters. If you want to become one, you can go to our website, hit the Support Us tab, and you can sign up on our Patreon channel. We also want to thank our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley. Doug Crumley is a coach for your finances. He is a private wealth advisor with Crumley & Associates, which is a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC. When you have the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Visit him at www.dougcrumleyjr.com.
Scott, we mentioned the deals page quite often. That's on our website, trailrunnernation.com. And we've made a lot of changes there, and we're really proud of it.
There's a lot of information there. Of course, there's the deals page where you can get all sorts of discounts on gear that we love and trust. We also have all of our other podcasts. We also have the Training Principles link. So we just started the Training Principles episodes at the beginning of this year. All those are kind of organized in one area. So if you're just getting into trail running and want to know the basics of where to start, go to the Training Principles tab. You can also sign up for our newsletter. We don't fill your mailbox full of junk every week or twice a week. Only when there's important things to happen, you'll also be notified when a new podcast hits the air.
So go to trailrunnernation.com.